Hello, today is Tuesday, April 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, after 5 years without a trace, a video purporting to be the leader of ISIS is released. A California synagogue continues to reel after an attack on worshipers over the weekend.
People cry, screaming, run, but I focus all the kids. I focus the kids going this way.
Also ahead, Madonna has a major performance planned for the upcoming Billboard Music Awards. It's all on today's International Edition. The Islamic State group's leader has appeared in a video, or allegedly, for the first time in 5 years. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
In the video released by the group's propaganda arm, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is seen with a bushy gray and red beard, sitting on the floor with what appears to be a machine gun next to him. It's the first time he's been seen on video since giving a sermon in 2014 at a mosque in Mosul, which a few years later was badly damaged as Iraqi forces took on al-Baghdadi's militants.
Oh. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Seldon joins us now for more on the significance of this. Jeff, tell us what you know.
For the last day or so, there's been a lot of speculation that was building online, primarily by Islamic State supporters, that a new video was going to be coming out. And when it came out on Monday, it was a more than 18-minute long video featuring a man claiming to be Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the ISIS leader, sitting cross-legged in front of a white backdrop with a gun at his side and some pillows, talking about recent events, including the fall of Baghouz, the town in northeastern Syria that was the last to remain under Islamic State control,
right,
and also about the bombings in Sri Lanka, the Easter Sunday bombings in Sri Lanka, which killed more than 250 people and was quickly claimed by Islamic State. In the video, a man claiming to be Baghdadi said that the Sri Lanka attacks were vengeance for the fall of Baghouz and insinuated that this is the type of vengeance that awaits the coalition and its allies for standing up against the Islamic State. He also painted the struggle of Islamic State not so much as one as the struggle for the survival of a caliphate, but as a battle of attrition that would continue until, according to the words on the video, until Judgment Day.
Officials in Sri Lanka have been pointing in another direction for who they suspect. Isn't that correct?
Well, this is one of the complications and one of the dangers of Islamic State. Sri Lankan officials have focused on two local terrorist groups that, until the Easter Sunday bombings, hadn't pulled off much of anything in terms of deadly attacks or even significant attacks. But what intelligence officials, what defense officials, what analysts will tell you about Islamic State is that Islamic State is very good at taking disgruntled terrorists and co-opting them under their black banner. And that seems to be, from what everybody knows so far, again, the investigation into the Sri Lanka attacks are still ongoing, seems to be what happened. You had a group of Islamic State foreign fighters that had traveled to Iraq and Syria, had returned to Sri Lanka, and some of them got involved in these other groups, eventually through social media, other forms of communication online, were co-opted into the Islamic State. And so on this video, this new video, purportedly from Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, Baghdadi is praising that effort and saying more of this is to come.
How significant is it that he's reappearing like this?
It's significant in some ways, perhaps not so significant in others. If this is confirmed, and U.S. intelligence agencies, defense agencies are still looking at the video and have yet to verify, to authenticate, in fact, this is Baghdadi. If they do, though, this will have been the first time anyone's seen his face in a video in almost 5 years. The last time was July 2014, when Islamic State still held the Iraqi city of Mosul, and he gave a sermon at the Great Mosque in Mosul. Since then, there have been two audio recordings, most recently in August 2018, when Islamic State was already losing a lot of territory, and that message was to encourage ISIS followers, ISIS fighters, to hold the line, to not give up faith, and continue to defend the caliphate. In this video, there's not a lot of mention of the caliphate, except for the praise of the fighters who defended Baghouz, the last city that ISIS had, that fell to U.S.-backed forces last month. On March 23rd is when victory was declared. And he also, the man claiming to be Baghdadi, praises the work of Islamic State, what he calls our brothers, in the provinces, saying that There have been over 290 vengeance operations over eight countries. He singles out an operation a couple of weeks ago in Libya by the Islamic State branch there, which has persisted despite having almost been wiped out at one point.
All right, that is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon. Thanks for the update. An Army veteran who converted to Islam and discussed launching various terror attacks throughout Southern California has been arrested and is in custody as he is suspected of allegedly plotting to bomb a white supremacist rally as retribution for the New Zealand mosque attacks. U.S. Attorney Nick Hanna says Mark Domingo's alleged terror plot was thwarted by undercover agents.
He was taken into custody after he took receipt of what he thought were pressure cooker bombs and after he traveled to Long Beach to survey the site where his intended victims were to congregate.
Mark Domingo, an infantry man who served a combat stint in Afghanistan, was arrested Friday after visiting a park in Long Beach where authorities say he planned to plant homemade explosive devices made with nail-filled pressure cookers in advance of a Nazi rally scheduled for Sunday. A criminal complaint said he'd been planning since March to manufacture and use a weapon of mass destruction in order to commit mass murder. At a memorial service on Monday, family and friends remembered Lori Kay, the woman killed in the shooting at Southern California's synagogue on the last day of the Jewish holiday of Passover. Mourners talked about Kay being a generous person dedicated to spreading kindness. The service drew a packed congregation, including three people wounded in the attack. Rochelle Schwartz was inside the synagogue with her daughter at the time of this attack.
My dear friend, her daughter was next to me, and I just remember getting her down and covering her with my body and telling her, please be quiet, please be quiet. I don't want the shooter to know that we're here.
8-year-old Noya Dahan was wounded by shrapnel from the bullets, and she is now forever changed.
Well, I don't really feel safe because this is not the first and definitely not the last time this is going to happen. So now I just know, like, to watch out and stuff for dangerous things to happen.
Kay was killed 6 months to the day that 11 worshippers were killed at a Pittsburgh synagogue in the deadliest attack on the American Jewish community. The latest shooting comes as the FBI reports hate crimes have risen 3 years in a row in the United States. Joining us to talk more about that part of the story is Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State University in Southern California. Why do you think we're seeing this rise in hate crimes?
In the past, we had looked at religion merging into extremism. I think now it's really a combination of things, including politics merging into extremism, and sometimes religion, race, politics intertwine. One of the things that we've seen here in the United States, since 1992, there's been only 4 years where religion hate crimes exceeded 20%, according to the FBI. Three of them are the last three. Another thing, our center is coming out with a study. For the fifth consecutive, hate crimes in 30 of America's largest cities went up and at the steepest incline that it's been since 2015. And the group with the second highest percentage increase, Jews, up 9.3% in a representative population and geographic sample of 10 cities across the United States. So we saw an increase of 9.3% in 2018. This is the latest data. This is above and beyond the FBI data. But if it holds true, we'll see a fourth year when the FBI comes out with their data. I think that'll happen. California is looking like it's going to see an increase for 2018 when the FBI and the state comes out with their data. Florida looks like as well, and tech. So bottom line is it looks like we may see another consecutive year of increases. We've seen an increase in white nationalists and far-right motivated individuals committing homicides. But the bottom line is, across ideology, we're seeing people get radicalized on the internet, and we're seeing a link, a chain of folks who are adhering to something called propaganda of the deed. Back in the pre-internet days, it used to be that white nationalist neo-Nazis would commit an act of violence, and that itself was the message to fellow travelers about what to do and where to direct this aggression. Now these folks are not only getting radicalized on the internet and finding folklore on it, they want to enter the folklore with their own writings, manifestos, or even graphic depictions. This is a disturbing angle that has emerged, and it's something the social media companies are going to have to grapple with.
Is there any explanation in your studies as to why we are seeing such a rise?
One of the reasons, I think, for the rise, at least on the darker corners of the internet, is that that's where the gravity is for bigoted expression. That's where that sludge will eventually settle. So I think part of this is the fragmenting of the internet. Another thing, I think, demographic changes and how people feel about these demographic changes, whether it's a change with regard to religion. Recent surveys have shown that, for instance, we have as many non-believers or doubtful believers as there are major faiths like Catholicism in the United States, about 23% each. We're seeing social and political divisions, and we are more entrenched and polarized in those divisions compared with years past. And when that happens, that allows a spectrum of extremism to have some traction with people who are angry and fearful. And particularly with the echo chamber of a fragmented internet, we are seeing people, particularly those who are angry, sociopathic, or have disorders, acting out like this terrorist did in Poway, California.
Would you say it's across the world, basically across the board, or in specific parts of the world?
The United States, Canada, most of Western Europe has seen an increase. And a lot of this is relating to some developments that are going on with regard to demographic change, immigration, and religion. Far-right parties are getting in the double digits in many parts of Europe. And we're seeing spikes in violence in Europe around political events. So what I think we're seeing is part of the hate crime data is responding generally to a coarsening in politics and the coalescence of race, religion, and other characteristics with politics and political conflict. So, for instance, we saw violence around the Brexit vote in Britain, including the killing of an MP. So we are seeing politics be one of the catalysts with respect to hate crime.
All right. Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State University, Southern California. Sri Lanka's president has banned women from wearing face veils as part of an emergency law following the deadly Easter Sunday attacks that left 250 people dead. Officials say the ban, which went into effect Monday, will help security forces with the identification process as the country continues to investigate the attacks. Sri Lankan local media is also reporting that police have identified a woman and girl pulled Saturday from the rubble of the shootout between police and militants that ended in the deaths of 15 people, including 6 children. The pair were the wife and daughter of the suspected mastermind behind the attacks. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked to Elena Teplitz, the U.S. ambassador to Sri Lanka in Colombo, and asks if there's still an ongoing terror threat there.
Well, our travel advisory indicates what we know, and that is that we still believe there are terrorists actively plotting. I think the good news is that there has been a lot of progress in the investigation. The Sri Lankan authorities have been successful in apprehending suspects and finding safe houses. These are obviously very positive developments with regard to the immediate safety and security in the people and the people of the island. I think the challenge when you're looking at a situation like this is that a lot of coordination has to happen to disrupt these active plots. And then there's a lot of work that's going to have to go on behind the scenes going forward, coordination between intelligence and law enforcement, focus by the government on this global terror threat. So there's always going to be a need to be vigilant.
What has the United States done so far as reaction to the attacks that have taken place, and what further can this country do?
The United States has done a couple of things. First is we surged support to the government of Sri Lanka to help with the investigation and then apprehension of the active plotters. We have an FBI team here on the ground working hand in glove in a joint investigation with the Sri Lankan authorities. We also have been very vigilant about warning American citizens. We take seriously our obligation to protect our public and want to make sure that they have the best information possible so that they can make the best decisions about their environment. You might have noticed that our travel advisory has been upgraded twice since this event occurred, and that we are poised, of course, as new information comes in, to share with the public any threat that we might perceive as there. We also have been helping American citizens who were victims of this attack. So many Sri Lankans, so many families impacted by this, many others from the foreign community, but of course there were four Americans who lost their lives, four more who were injured in this, and we did our best to support them in an hour of need.
The Sri Lankan government, with all of its recent problems, is working well with you and helping to solve the problems. Is that correct?
That's right. We have a good cooperation, and they had welcomed the help.
There's a new development that Muslims in Sri Lanka will no longer be able to veil their faces. That under an emergency law ordered by President Sirisena. It bans all kinds of face coverings, so they say they can see people's identities. Do you have any reaction to that?
Well, the government is looking, I think, at a number of emergency measures. They certainly wanted to be able to respond promptly in the wake of this attack. We have been following their efforts in this regard and encouraging them, as President Sirisena himself said, to ensure that these measures are very focused and limited to the scope of this particular incident. The government has committed to addressing some of the poor human rights practices of the past. We've been encouraging them to reform their processes and approaches for the future. I think this is even more reason why that needs to be done, because respecting people's democratic rights, respecting the rights of communities, is something that can coexist in a democratic society with efforts to combat global terrorism. And the president's indication that these emergency powers would only be used to focus on the perpetrators of this terrible crime, I think, is an important acknowledgement of that.
How did you feel when this attack occurred? Here you are in a beautiful country, you have many things to do. What went through your mind when you heard that this had happened?
Well, the first thing that went through my mind with this, that this happened, is what can we do to help? We have obligations on a number of levels, and it's a responsibility that we're certainly very proud to carry out, even while we're terribly saddened by the circumstances that we sometimes have to engage in. So our first task, actually, was to find out who might have been caught up in this terrible event. We had teams out searching the hospitals and the morgues to find American citizens who might have been killed or injured in this, to make sure that we could support their families. And then we were simultaneously engaging with our hosts here with the Sri Lankan government to see what we could do to assist and bring our resources to bear. When a tragedy of this kind strikes, such a senseless attack, our first impulse is to see what we can do to help everybody who's been impacted.
All right, that is U.S. Ambassador to Sri Lanka, Elena Teplitz, speaking to VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein submits his resignation. Uganda's opposition figure Bobi Wine is imprisoned. Russian missiles in Venezuela heighten U.S. tensions. And former Vice President Joe Biden holds his first 2020 campaign event. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. More than 150,000 people in northern Mozambique are struggling to recover from Tropical Cyclone Kenneth, which hit Cabo Delgado province Friday and Saturday. The storm has left tens of thousands homeless as continuing heavy rain is cutting off many communities from aid. At least 38 people have died. Claudio Gelaya, an emergency specialist with UNICEF, is working in Pemba to help coordinate recovery operations for the United Nations Children's Agency. He tells my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson that the storm has devastated the region and complicated efforts to recover from Cyclone Idai, which hit Mozambique's central coast last month.
December, and the whole province is currently under rain. It has been raining a lot since yesterday. Heavy rain. We have recorded heavy rainfall yesterday in Pemba and the coastal areas of the province. There are some areas that there's no access by road. So it's 5 districts. We cannot reach by road. We can only reach by either by plane or by boat. At the moment, as per the government estimation, we have around 168,000 people affected the whole province by the cyclone and then the flood. The government, in terms of displacement, we have around 20,000 people that are currently displaced and accommodated in 30,000 centers. So in terms of the biggest challenge now is under logistics, so to access the areas that are not accessible by road.
At this point, is there any sign of disease outbreaks? We had cholera after Cyclone Idai. Is there any sign of anything like that?
Fortunately, we do not have any sign yet. But the health authorities, as a prevention measure, they are already working on the activation of DRAL treatment center.
How does the damage from Cyclone Kenneth compare with Cyclone Idai?
The damage of Idai was much bigger than Kenneth. One of the evidence of that is the number of districts that were affected. Kenneth only affected a Cabo Delgado province, whereas Idai, for example, affected at least two big provinces, which is Sofala and Manila. Even in terms of number of people affected, Idai was bigger than Kenneth.
Is this new storm making it harder for the recovery efforts from Cyclone Idai?
Definitely, yes, because most of the supplies that we're bringing to respond to Kenneth are being moved from Beira, which were already prepositioned to respond to the Idai situation. So indeed, the issue of the funding is very critical at the moment because we already had the funding gap to respond to Idai, and now we have this impact of Kenneth that is requesting our attention in terms of resources and funding.
All right, that's Claudio Gelaya, emergency specialist with UNICEF. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. A groundbreaking movie director has died. AP Entertainment editor Oscar Wells Gabriel reports on the career of John Singleton.
They shot my brother! They shot my brother!
His first ever Hollywood movie crackled across the Hollywood landscape, providing a searing look at life in South Central Los Angeles. The release of Boys in the Hood earned John Singleton a Best Director nomination, making him the first African-American to get a nod for calling the shots in a major feature film. The movie, starring Lawrence Fishburne, Ice Cube, Angela Bassett, and Cuba Gooding Jr., led to other projects, most notably Poetic Justice, which paired two musicians in starring roles, Janet Jackson and Tupac Shakur. Singleton's other films included Rosewood and Too Fast, Too Furious. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
Well, Avengers Endgame is crushing the competition by setting multiple records at the box office. The new Walt Disney Company film shattered the record for biggest opening weekend with an estimated $350 million in ticket sales. That's just in the U.S. That was Friday with a record $156.7 million. It bested Star Wars The Force Awakens. The Marvel Comics superhero film also broke the record for the highest opening weekend globally of all time at the end of Friday. Joining us to talk more about this phenomenal success is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. So, Jeff, wow, this is a pretty unbelievable opening weekend.
Unbelievable. It shattered every box office record. $1.2 billion. I mean, how in the world is anyone ever going to be able to top that opening? And why? It's had a built-in audience for now 10 years. This comes to a close. The Marvel Cinematic Universe with these characters, with these actors. This is the 22nd film. I can't believe I've watched 22 Marvel films. And not only that, this is a sequel to Infinity War, which was out a year or two ago. So essentially, this is a 5-hour movie if you watch Part 1 and now Endgame together.
Oh, wow.
And and so much, I'm not going to give you my review mm-hmm. of Endgame because it has an encyclopedia worth of spoilers.
Really?
Yeah, so I'm just going to give you my reaction.
And my
reaction is, it is fantastic. It is the best. And on so many levels. Some of these characters, what they did, which I really loved what the writers did, and also the Russo brothers who directed both films. Not only do the Avengers get together to fight Thanos, if you remember in the last film, he got the Infinity Gauntlet and the stones that he can control the universe. And he snapped his fingers, and his whim, he destroyed 50% of all life in the universe. And so what they do, the Avengers have to get back together, pick up the pieces now. This is a couple years later. But what I love what the writers did is they gave every remaining Avenger his own little story, his or her. And what I mean was they each have their own personal demons, their own issues, and also they all get together to kick some butt. But each character gets to shine in this three-hour-plus movie. So if you have a favorite Avenger, if they survive, you will see just an incredible story. And I'm telling you, Lori, these are on Shakespearean level. It is
really?
Well written.
Wow.
Yes, they're superheroes, you know, but you believe everything. You really do.
It's very long, 3 hours. Does it go by quick, or is it tough to get through that much time, or is it so good that you don't even know the time is passing?
Well, I was waiting for somewhere to be, you know, slow down the movie and think, oh my gosh, this is tedious. It moves briskly. It moves. It's interesting. It's fascinating. It's exciting. It didn't feel like 3 hours at all. I can't believe it was 3 hours. I felt more like an hour and a half, 2 hours. So, no, don't go in with that mindset that it's a three-hour movie and you're looking at your watch. You won't do that. You're going to be watching the screen and having the best. But overall, the movie, it needs to be recognized for its writing and acting ability. Sure, the Academy and everyone recognizes these films for the special effects and costumes, but we need to go to the next level with this. Just like they did with Lord of the Rings 10 years ago, we need to recognize this movie for its acting ability and its writing. This is a watershed moment for Robert Downey Jr. He is just phenomenal as Iron Man in this, completing his 10-year run as the character. This is a great film. I've already seen it twice. I'm going to go see it a third time because I see so many different things every time I see it. So make sure you see it in the theater. See it in IMAX if you can. But Avengers, be part of this pop culture revolution. Get away from Game of Thrones and go see one of the most incredible movies ever made.
All right. Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video review at VegasFilmCritic.com. Madonna fans have a reason to rejoice. The Material Girl and Colombian singer Maluma will bring their new collaboration to life in a performance at next month's Billboard Music Awards. They'll sing Medellin at the May 1st event in Las Vegas. And Madonna has reportedly spent $5 million on a hologram for the show that is expected to be the hottest performance of the night. The song released last week is from Madonna's 14th album, Madam X, which comes out on June 14th. She says the Latin-flavored album was inspired from living in Lisbon, Portugal, for the last few years. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Sipping my pain just like champagne. Found myself dancing in the rain with you. I felt so naked and alive. Show me. For once I didn't have to hide myself. Dice, oye mamacita, ¿qué te pasa? Yeah. Mira que ya estamos en mi casa. Yeah. Si sientes que hay un viaje ahí en tu mente, será por el exceso de aguardiente. Pero mami, tranquila, tú solo vacila. Que estamos en Colombia y aquí rumbo en cada esquina. Y si tú quieres, nos vamos por Detroit. Tú sabes, si sé de dónde vienes, pues sé pa' dónde voy, ¿no? Ven conmigo, let's take a trip. Si te llevo por lugar lejano.